He served at the Pentagon as an Army JAG. He graduated from Notre Dame and has two law degrees from Boston University and Georgetown University. He's been practicing law for over 30 years. He's your family's personal attorney. It's time for the David Carrier Show.
Hello and welcome to the David Carrier Show. I'm David Carrier, your family's personal attorney. This is the place where we talk about estate planning, elder law, real estate, and business law. So give us a call, why don't you, at 888-463-2843. That's 888-463-2843. And we'll get your question, comment, or concern on the air. We also deal with, Will's Trust and Probate. We'd like to invite you to one of our free life plan workshops. These are the workshops we give every single week, and now it looks like we're giving them twice a week because, otherwise we'd have to put you off too long. So if there's a particular date or time that works well for you, let us know. You know, when you call the office, just let us know or drop us an email. And even if the workshop has already been filled, just let them know, because we usually keep a few seats in the back of the room, you know, leave those open just in case. So if there's a day or a time that works especially well for you, as I say, let us know and we'll see what we can arrange. I'm going to get right to some of the emails here. One of the first things when I first went on active duty, right, back in the day, you know, this is back in the early 80s, I was a appellate defense counsel for Army Legal Services Agency. And what that means is if you got convicted at court-martial, okay, if you got convicted at court-martial and you were discharged, bad conduct discharge, dishonorable discharge, or if you were confined for more than a year, your case was automatically appealed. It's an automatic review of the case. So that's what that's what they had me doing with my background in tax law. You know, let's make him a criminal lawyer. Why not? Okay, so we're doing that, and one of the first things I learned, and it took me a while, it took me probably 6 or 8 months. Was to kind of separate. Well, it was the whole truth stranger than fiction thing, okay? Because you'd have clients, and the guys would call you from Fort Leavenworth, and they'd be saying, you know, Captain Carrier, does it make any sense that I would do than whatever it was they'd been convicted of doing? You know, that was always the Captain Carrier. Does it make any sense that I would do this? This just doesn't make any sense, and that just doesn't make any sense, and you know, all the rest of it. And I'd be like, yeah, that doesn't make. Wow, this injustice here. You know, let's see what we can. It doesn't make any sense. But after about 6 months, what I realized was I was being strung along, okay? And, you know, I agree. I agree. It doesn't make any sense that you, as a staff sergeant, you know, with all these good recommendations and all the schooling and all, it doesn't make sense that you'd be selling hash in Schwäbisch Gmund, okay? It doesn't make any sense. But you know something? You were. Are you with me on that? You know, it doesn't make any sense. But truth is stranger than fiction. And this email kind of falls into the same category. It's like, I don't doubt what this person is. I bet you it happened exactly the way he says, okay? But it's so far out there that you just can't go with it. See, here's the email. My parents, and see if I'm connecting this up right, right? My parents put a property, real estate, I guess, in my name before they passed away. Okay, so mom and dad deeded the house to the kid, deeded the cottage, let's say, to the writer, and verbally conveyed that it belonged to me and my two brothers. All right, not unusual. Okay, sonny boy, we're giving you the cottage, but, you know, you're supposed to share it with your brothers. Several years later, after mom and dad died, I deeded the property into one of my brother's name. All right, so mom and dad deeded it to me. Now I'm deeding it to brother. Question, why the heck would you deed it to brother? Answer, maybe you're going through bankruptcy. Maybe there's a divorce. Maybe you're afraid of getting sued. There are reasons why people would do this. Anyway, he did do it. I transferred the property, the same property, I gave the cottage to the brother. My mom was still alive, and the four of us agreed. Mom and the four sons, my three sons, right? Mom and the sons agreed on the same verbal agreement that the property belonged to me and my two brothers. All right, so now, one more time, everyone's agreeing. My brother that held title to the property, that owned the property, became terminally ill. Now, understand, it doesn't matter at this point, really, what mom says, because mom and dad already transferred the property to the first guy. But anyway, became terminally ill, and without notifying me or my other brother, deeded the property to his daughter. She evicted my living brother. So the brother was at the cabin or the cottage or whatever the heck it was. And now niece evicts the brother, evicts her uncle. Now, what does that mean to evict? Well, you know, at that point, what you're saying is you don't have a possessory interest. You don't get to live in this house, in the cabin, whatever it was. Okay, that would have been the time. You know, there's another red light. That would have been the time to litigate this thing. That would have been the time to fight it. Okay. Well, my mom, her grandmother, and her uncles, we all agreed that I could live in this, but he deeded it to her. And good luck for that. So now he gets evicted, and is fighting our claims to a 1/3 ownership. What does that mean, fighting? She already won, it seems to me. The property is located here in Michigan. I drafted the quick claim deed over to my now deceased brother. A quick claim deed. You know what a quick claim deed? Quit claim, not quick. Not quick. Quit. Q-U-I-T. Quit claim. I'm quitting any claims that I may have. I'm giving up any claims that I may have to this property. I'm giving them up over to the brother. That's what he did. There were no written details on the deed as it went into my name much earlier. What? Can you say non sequitur? There were no written details on the deed as it was when it went into my name much earlier. In other words, they did the same thing. You know, the mom and dad deeded it to this guy, to the writer, and then our writer sent it over to the brother. Do I and my living brother have any recourse? Not just no, but heck no. The attorney that drafted the first conveyance was aware that the property was all ours. Okay, so maybe when, you know, the attorney drew up the first quit claim deed, you know, maybe he could say, well, you know, we did the quit claim deed as part of a, you know, as part of a estate plan that was designed to get it all. I mean, maybe the attorney could do that. Of course, he'd be pretty much confessing to malpractice if he did. he did admit that. Or maybe they just say, hey, I need a quit claim deed, and, you know, this is just what we need. I mean, who knows what's going on here, you know? And that's the problem. There's a thing called the statute of frauds. And what the statute of frauds says is that if you have an agreement for sale of property more than, I think it's like $100, or any contract, any agreement involving real estate, then it has to be in writing, okay? And if it's not in writing, then you didn't have an agreement, all right? So the deed has to be in writing. All these understandings have to be in writing. Now, so that's the sort of statute of frauds. That's the, you know, real estate sort of thing. Okay, contracts. But now there's another area of the law called trust. And in order to have a trust, you don't even need to have anything written down. You can agree to a trust verbally. Okay? You can agree verbally to a trust. You can agree a trust can arise out of the actions of the parties. Okay? So you could, the brothers here, the uncles, could say that their deceased brother held it in trust for all of them. The problem is you've got a written record that suggests that that's not what happened. Okay? So, is it possible? Is it possible for everything that our email writer says, is it possible for all of those things to be true? Yes, it's possible. Is it possible also to come up with a legal theory where the brothers would get the property back? Yeah, it's possible. It's possible. But, you know, that may be the truth. But it's so far afield from what the way things usually go, you know, you couldn't hold out any hope that it's actually going to, they're actually going to get the cabin, the cottage, whatever it is back. You've been listening to The David Carrier Show. I'm David Carrier, your family's personal attorney. Welcome back to the David Carrier Show. I'm David Carrier, your family's personal attorney. Don't you do things that are stranger than fiction? Come to a life plan workshop and find out how to do it correctly. 888-463-2843 is the number for you to call. Love to see you at one of those life plan workshops. You know, the things that folks do is just, and sometimes with advice. You know, apparently in our last email, there was an attorney involved at some point. But, you know, the bigger point here, there's two ways to use a lawyer, okay? And I wonder which way this guy was retained. The one way to use a lawyer is like a Coke machine. You say, hey, I need a whatever it is. I need a power of attorney. I need a trust. I need a will. I need a transfer on death deed. And, you know, you put your money in the slot, you hit the button, and out comes the document. Right, and that's a way to use a lawyer, and it's a way that many people do. And then there's the other way of using a lawyer, which is to say, hey, here's what I'm trying to accomplish. What do you think I ought to do? And I wonder in with our email where the guy drafted the quitclaim deed, if it wasn't just a matter of the attorney can, you know, you can stand on your head and say, hey, look, you really shouldn't do it this way. There's better ways to do it. If the client insists, you know, no, I want to do it this way. Frankly, at this point, I just declined the representation, but, yeah, that hasn't always been the case. You know, sometimes, you know, it's ethical and all, you know, you can say, earthquake going on. You can, what do you call them? You can do what the attorney, what the client tells you to do, even if you don't think it's the good idea. All you have to do is have them sign off saying, yeah, I told them to do that. We've got Dorothy on the line. Good morning, Dorothy. Welcome to the David Carrier Show.
Good morning.
How can I help?
Thanks for taking my call. I have some questions about property.
Sure.
First of all, my neighbor tells me his garage is in with 1/2 foot of my property line. Then he says it's illegal for him to sell his property without my permission. Is that real? Is that true?
Well, it's possible. I mean, most every jurisdiction has what they call setback requirements,
okay,
where you can't build within a certain distance of the lot line. You know, so you have side yard setbacks and front yard setbacks and backyard setbacks. You know, sometimes they're different. Sometimes they don't want you building within a certain amount of the right of way or the road, and sometimes that's maybe 20 or 30 feet, and then on the side yard, it could be much less. How long has the structure been there?
As far as I know, we've been here 31 years. The garage was there.
Hmm.
He also has a pole barn that is alongside that garage.
Is the pole barn newer construction?
Yes.
See, that might be the. It might not be the garage. It would probably be the pole barn. And I don't really think. Frankly, I'm not so sure that, see, if he's violating the side yard setback, then it's not really up to you, Dorothy, to let him do it or not. It's more up to the municipality. He'd have to get a variance from the zoning law.
He insists that he needs the buyer to ask me to give him permission to sell his property. It just doesn't make sense, but, you know, that's why I'm asking you.
I'm with you on that. It doesn't make sense.
Okay.
Because, I mean, you're the one who could complain. You're the one who's most likely to complain about the side yard setback to say, hey, you built it too close to the line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as a practical matter, you know, the assessor is unlikely to come out and, or the township, whatever, is unlikely to come out and complain about it. And if he received the building permit, see, that's another question. Did he get a building permit for that pole barn? If he did not get a building permit, right?
Yeah.
Well, now he's got to tear down the pole barn anyway. Or may have to tear it down. But if he did get a building permit, then they should have, you know, they should have checked out the setback requirement. I mean, when they approved the, when the city of Wyoming? Or,
yes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, very efficient housing department over there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'd be surprised that they would approve something that didn't meet the setback requirements. Unless he got a variance for it, which probably you'd have known about that, you know, because they would have had to inform you. So, yeah, it is kind of, I mean, the only reason they would come to you would be to see if you would not object. But I'm just having a hard time figuring out why you'd be the one naturally to complain.
Right.
Okay. But if you say, oh, I'm not going to complain now, it doesn't mean you can't complain later. I mean, it wouldn't be binding. So then, now you have to wonder, well, who is it that's telling him that he needs you not to object to it?
His buyer wants my permission. Person purchasing his property says they need my permission for him to sell.
Well, you see, if I was the buyer on that property, then I would want to square it with you to make sure that you were okay that I was violating the side yard setback, because I wouldn't want to, you know, 2 weeks after I move in, I wouldn't want to find out then that you had a big problem with it,
mm-hmm.
Right? So that makes a little bit of sense.
Okay.
But it wouldn't be a that wouldn't be any real protection for the buyer, because it's a violation of the law. You can't. Yeah, it's okay to murder me. Go ahead. You know. Wait a second. You can't agree to everything. So, yeah, kind of confusing. I think the first step would be to find out what is the side yard setback and did he have a building permit for this pole barn.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those would be the first. If there's no side yard setback, well, then that's not an issue. If he didn't have a building permit, that's an issue. But you can't waive it. You can't say it doesn't matter. Okay?
Yes.
Anything else, Dorothy?
Yes, I did have another question. What
okay.
do you know about wetlands in West Michigan? Are there any protected wetlands, and what are the stipulations?
Yeah, well, there's lots of wetlands. Sure.
Are they protected?
Well, it depends. I tell you what, we're going to the news right now.
Yep.
And let me, when we get back, we can go through some of the protections that there are for wetlands. You're listening to the David Carrier Show. I'm David Carrier, your family's personal attorney. Welcome back to the David Carrier Show. I'm David Carrier, the place, and you found the place where we have fun. at least as that relates to estate planning, elder law, real estate, and business law. Give us a call, why don't you? 888-463-2843. That's 888-463-2843. 888-GO-DAVID, and we'll get your question, comment, or concern on the air. We also do those life plan workshops that you can sign up for. If you go to the website, davidcarrierlaw.com, or just drop me an email, david@davidcarrierlaw.com. We've got Dorothy on the line. Dorothy's wondering about wetlands in West Michigan, and are they regulated or not, and what have you. Summarizing correctly?
Yes.
Let me ask you, where is the wetland that you're particularly concerned about, and what do you know about it?
Well, it's my property and 20 acres around me here in Wyoming.
Okay. The wetlands in Michigan are regulated if they're connected with one of the Great Lakes or Lake St. Clair. Okay, not there. Are you within 1,000 feet of one of the Great Lakes or Lake St. Clair?
No.
Are you connected with an inland lake, pond, river, or stream?
No.
Are you located within 500 feet of an inland lake, pond, river, or stream?
No, don't think so.
Okay. Are you not connected with one of the Great Lakes or Lake St. Clair or an inland lake, pond, stream, all the rest, but more than 5 acres in size?
The total property is mine is 5, and then there's other properties.
Yeah, but the question is, are the wetlands more than 5 acres itself?
Possibly accumulated, but not connected.
Okay. Well, yeah, they don't care who owns it. If the area of wetland itself is more than 5 acres, that's what they're looking at.
I see.
Okay. So even if it's less than 5 acres, if the DEQ has determined, quote, that these wetlands are essential to the preservation of the state's natural resources and has notified you. Mm-hmm. So if you have a 1 acre, you know, kettle hole or something like that on your property, and they told you, hey, that's essential to the preservation of the natural resources, and they let you know, then, you have to get a permit. Now, here's what is it you want to do with it, Dorothy, if I could ask?
I don't want to do anything, but I'm concerned about someone else building on other wetlands near me.
Oh, okay. All right. So they require a permit if you want to put fill in the wetland.
Mm-hmm.
All right. If you want to, dredge, remove, or permit the removal of soil or minerals from the wetland, okay,
mm-hmm.
construct, operate, or maintain any use or development in the wetland, or drain surface water from the wetland.
Mm-hmm.
And if they, obviously, if they're going to build on it, that's part of what they want to do. And then the DEQ has to determine that the permit's in the public interest, otherwise lawful, necessary to realize benefits from the activity, without any unacceptable disruption to aquatic resources. Okay? So there you go. I mean, those are the sorts of things. If what they want to do is drain the wetland and put up a house, but it's a 6-acre wetland, including 3 on their side, 3 on your side, it's going to have to be permitted.
Yes.
You know, and then you just go through the application, the permit process, and obviously you would you'd be part of that process.
I see. Well, thank you very much.
You're more than welcome. Thanks for calling. You're listening to the David Carrier Show. I'm David Carrier, your family's personal attorney. Yeah, the thing with a lot of the environmental stuff is it's not, I own 5, and, I have a 3-acre wetland, and they have what is the size of the wetland altogether? You know, that doesn't really depend on the, ownership. Let's see. When a life estate owner leaves the estate, what kind of time are we looking at? When I first got this email, I thought it was about when they die, right? But that's not it. The rest of it says, what we need to know is when a life estate owner leaves the estate, meaning leaves the property, what are the timelines that can be known as they have abandoned the estate? In other words, mom and dad gave Junior the life estate, and after death it goes to whoever else. And the whoever else, so Junior has vacated the premises, and they're wondering, well, when do we get possession? And the answer is when Junior dies. That's just a straight-up answer to it. The fact that somebody is no longer occupying the property is really pretty much irrelevant. The only thing that matters is whose name you know, who actually has the right to use the property. Now, what if there's a, you know, back taxes and all the rest? Well, typically the life estate owner is responsible for those. Could the life estate owner, you know, lose the property? Yeah, it could happen if they don't pay the taxes. And the remaindermen, you know, the people who are going to take the remainder, if they're not on the ball, they could lose out too. But they would have to, you know, they would have the opportunity to step up and to pay those taxes. So, you know, assuming that the life estate owner, you know, just didn't do that. But vacating the property, leaving, that's no, has nothing to do with the estate. See, now here's the thing. It is not at all unusual when we're putting a plan together where parents would like, you know, junior or sister or somebody to stay on the property, to be able to use that property as their home. Maybe there are grandkids involved. Maybe there's a developmental disability. Comes up a lot of times with blended family. You know, you want the surviving spouse to be able to use the home, even though it was yours to start with. Well, there are ways of dealing with that without going to the life estate that really work much, much better because they're more tailored to the circumstances. So, for example, if Sonny Boy's been sleeping on the futon in the basement for the last 30 years and mom and dad still don't, you know, say, well, if we die, you know, we want Sonny Boy to still have a roof over his head, so we're going to give him a life estate. That's sort of the, you know, sometimes we say if you talk to 10 attorneys and I'm the last one, I'll be the first one telling you this. Well, the first 9 attorneys are going to say, oh, let's give Sonny Boy a life estate. You know, you want to make sure Sonny Boy has a roof over his head? Give him a life estate and the property. Well, you know, here's the problem. What if, and this is the problem that's brought up by the questioner here, by our emailer. You know, what if Sonny Boy moves somewhere else? Well, why should everybody else wait until he dies before they get the property? Or Sonny Boy could go to the brothers and sisters and say, hey, yeah, I'm moving somewhere else, but guess what? You're not getting anything until I die. Tell you what, how about you take $100,000 property? Why don't you guys each take $5,000 right now and just sign it over to me? You know, because otherwise I'm I'm younger and healthier than you are. You know, I'm going to live forever. You know, you got to wait 30 years before you get anything. Or you can have $5,000 right now. Which would you prefer? You see, that's not what mom and dad intended by leaving Junior with the life estate, you know, to upset the balance that way. But that is what can occur. Whereas if mom and dad had set up the trust, a trust for Junior saying, hey, as long as this is your primary residence, as long as you don't rent it out, as long as, you know, whatever other factors we want to put in there, right? But if you don't pay the taxes, if you vacate the property, if you do these things, then your right to occupy the property is over. Your residence trust, we call it, is done. And now we're going to sell it and distribute the proceeds. That's, you know, it's a much more tailored way of doing it rather than the life estate. Really hate to see life estates unless there's a very compelling reason to do the life estate. Typically, you know, that's like trying to crack an egg with a sledgehammer. You know, it'll crack the egg, but there are other consequences. You're listening to the David Carrier Show. I'm David Carrier, your family's personal attorney. At the workshop, we do not use sledgehammers or crack eggs with them, so it's safe. So we would like to see you there. Just sign up, 888-463-2843. That's 888-GO-DAVID, and you can sign up by talking to somebody, or you can go online, davidcarrierlaw.com, or drop me an email, david@davidcarrierlaw.com. No sledgehammers, I promise. Welcome back to the David Carrier Show. I'm David Carrier, your family's personal attorney. You have found the place where we talk about estate planning, elder law, real estate, wetlands, anything you want, No problem. Just give us a shout, 888-463-2843. Let's get to some of our other emails here. Special needs trust. This is a good one. Does a trust that failed to be executed have any bearing when mentioned in a will? Should the draft of the trust be admitted in the probate court? Can it be part of the letters of administration? Can it be any part of the petition to probate? That's a good question, you know. It is not at all unusual. In fact, it's typical that when people do trust-based estate planning, that they wind up in probate anyway. Okay? I mean, the big reason to do the trust is to avoid probate. The secret that everybody knows is that they don't avoid probate. The trusts don't avoid probate, which has nothing to do with the trust themselves, but the way that these things are handled, because most people don't fund them. Most people don't fund their trusts. Most attorneys don't make you fund the trust, and so you wind up going through probate anyway. in our office, we make you fund the trust. I mean, we kind of do it as part of the We absolutely do it as part of the process. You don't get your documents. You don't get to feel good that, oh boy, I got this done. Look at all these papers I got. You don't get to feel that until you've been through the funding process, because everybody knows that once you get the book, right? Once you get the binder or the blue cardboard or where the heck it is, you're not going to go back and fund it. You know, you're just happy to get the heck out of there. You're just happy to be able to check that off your bucket list. We get it. We understand. On the other hand, I mean, I don't know about you, but I don't like the thought that 90% of what I do is just wasted. Okay? I don't like that, and which is why we always do fund the trust. But now we've got a situation here. This is the email situation where the will was done. Now, you always do a will in connection with the trust. You always do one. Because, you know, nobody has a crystal ball, right? And what if some other assets show up or what have you? But so you always do a will that says, if there is anything in my name, there shouldn't be, but if there is anything in my name, I want to put that into the trust when I die through probate. Okay? That's what the pour-over will is for. So if people say, oh, don't worry about funding the trust, we got the pour-over will. What they're saying is, don't worry about avoiding probate, because we're going to go to probate. You know, we're going to do the will, which means probate. That's just what it is. Okay? So the pour-over will is, we always do it. The goal is not to ever have to use it. It's extremely rare that we do have to use it when we fund the trusts. You know, when we do, we're kind of fanatical about funding the things. But this situation is one where we've got the will, but the trust hasn't been signed. Now, that's a head scratcher, isn't it? I mean, how did you get the will signed, but not the trust? How did that happen? I don't know. Truth is stranger than fiction. Maybe there's an explanation for it. Maybe there's a very good logical, et cetera, explanation for saying, I'm going to put all my stuff into the trust, and you validly execute that with the two witnesses and the notary and the whole nine. You do that one okay. But somehow at the same point, you didn't also sign the trust. Why didn't you? I mean, that's a little mind-boggling right there, okay? But let's leave that aside for the moment and just accept that it happened, that the pen ran out of ink or something. I don't know. I suppose that'd be a reason, the pen ran out of ink. Anyway, so we've got a will that says put it in the trust, but the trust has not been executed. Will the trust be admitted anyway? Will the trust still work? Well, it depends. You know, we were talking about that earlier. It depends. What are the facts surrounding it? Did the pen just run out of ink? You know, or do we not decide what was going to be in the trust yet? But we said, hey, when I die, put it in the trust, if I've got a trust at that point. You know, I mean, what you need to know a little bit more about what was going on. But, you know, just because it wasn't signed is not the end of the story. That's the beginning of the story. I did a will, I did a trust, except I didn't. I signed one, I didn't sign the other. But maybe the fact is, let's just assume some facts. Maybe the fact is that I went through the whole process, and there's people there who can testify that what was written here in the trust was what I wanted to happen. It really, really was. But the pen ran out of ink, or I lost my copy, or I don't know. For some reason, we didn't get through the formalities of signing it, but it really does reflect what I want. Well, you know, that would be testimony, I think. I don't think a probate judge would have any problem listening to a story like that. Believing it, well, that's another question, but would you get into court on that? I think the answer is yes. I think the answer is yes, especially if the trust is referenced, if this particular trust, this document is referenced in the will. Now, I don't think you can get around having to go to court on that. I don't think you can get around having to ask the court to adopt this unsigned will, the unsigned trust as the valid representation, valid expression of what the person wanted. And in the Michigan law, under the Estate Protected Individual Code, we have a provision that pretty much lets the judge give credence to whatever the judge wants to give credence to. It's a very, you know, it's one of those exceptions that, you know, you have to do it like this, 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 and this. On the other hand, if you haven't done A, B, C, and D, but the judge is kind of convinced, well, then I guess that'll be okay. All right. Very open-ended. I haven't heard a lot of feedback where it's being abused or, you know, stretched beyond reality. But it's a troubling provision of the law. But in a situation like this, where for some reason, which we don't know yet, the trust was not signed, although the will was, and the will references this particular document, well, that might be a case where the judge would allow it. You know, can it be any part of the petition? Well, yeah, it could be. In fact, you'd have to do that. I got about 30 seconds. Can I probate my mom's estate that has passed without a will, without a lawyer, or no will? There's my brother, myself as heirs. She left a house that is assessed by the township at $42,000. It is a dump, and the person would like to buy it from us at $18,000. There is no will. She owed back taxes of $8,000, which is going to be paid. A lot of exclamation points in this one. This is all there is, exclamation point. Tell what forms I need to start this process or all that is needed to do this. Well, you can do it yourself, right? I mean, there are books out there on how to do it yourself. I wouldn't recommend that. You've got about $10,000 of, you know, to the good, it looks like, after taxes. You know, so spend a few thousand dollars on a lawyer and just have it done right. I mean, that's what I would say. There's not enough here, really, to justify going through a lot of hassle for it, would seem to me. You're listening to The David Carrier Show. I'm David Carrier, your family's personal attorney. Looking forward to seeing you at one of our life plan workshops. Just get on over to davidcarrierlaw.com. Sign up today. I'm David Carrier, your family's personal attorney.
You've been listening to The David Carrier Show, a lively discussion addressing your questions and concerns, but not legal advice. There is a big difference. So when making decisions that affect your family, your property, or yourself, the best advice is to seek good advice, specific to your unique needs. If you missed any of today's show or would like additional information about the law offices of David Carrier, please visit davidcarrierlaw.com.